This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
Day featuring top artists like Buddy Guy, the Neville Brothers, Habib Coit, the Wailers, and Taj Mahal. Get early bird tickets till April 16th at any Houston area HEB location or online at ifest.org or at the gate. Come downtown to the Houston International Festival, brought to you by KPFT Houston.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening, this is Jack Polinsky.
I'm Brian Erickson.
And I'm Glenn Holt.
And I'm Brian Levinka.
And on tonight's show, the Gay Men's Chorus of Houston has a performance next Monday night at Jones Hall, Echoes of the 80s, and it includes performances by the Flyboys Flag Troop Houston. J.D. Doyle will interview Ron Morris, who will be performing at Mojo Rising the following Thursday night. That's March 27th. And we'll have music from both the Gay Men's Chorus and from Ron Morris. In our second hour, J.D. Doyle's Queer Music Heritage, presenting this month's Horse McDonald and Alicia Bridges. But first, it's News Wrap from This Way Out.
I'm Rick Watts.
And I'm Sherry Lund.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending March 22nd, 2008. The International Lesbian and Gay Association, or ILGA, has called off its 24th World Conference, which was to be held in Canada's Quebec City from May 14th to 18th. ILGA is the world's premier international queer advocacy group. It's a 30-year-old federation of more than 600 LGBT organizations and associated members, such as city governments, from some 90 countries. The Coalition Gay et Lesbienne du Québec was the primary organizer of May's World Conference, while acknowledging that new leadership there took over this challenging task at a late date. ILGA's board co-chair said in a statement this week that a recent site visit confirmed a current lack of preparedness and the lack of funding necessary for the conference to take place. They also noted that participation from the Global South through scholarships would have been very limited at best, and this is a fundamental component of an ILGA World Conference. The co-chair said they hope that the conference can be rescheduled and issued a formal call for new proposals from ILGA member organizations for hosting the World Conference later this year. They emphasized, however, that any local organizer must take on significant responsibility for paying for the gathering because ILGA does not have the capacity to fully fund the conference.
Meanwhile, the mayors of the Latvian capital of Riga and the Estonian capital of Tallinn have refused to take part in a European campaign affirming freedom of assembly and expression for LGBT people. Pride events in both cities have been violently attacked by skinheads and religious fundamentalists in recent years. The European branch of ILGA wanted the leaders of those cities to join 19 others in Europe who've declared their support for the initiative. They include the mayors of Paris, Nicosia, Amsterdam, London, Stockholm, Barcelona, Venice, Vienna, Copenhagen, Budapest, Zurich, Berlin, and Dublin.
But the openly gay mayor of Paris, Bertrand Delanoy, won easy re-election on March 16th. He's become a popular political figure, not only in Paris, but across the country, particularly with the poor and middle classes. French President Nicolas Sarkozy's party lost majorities in several towns and cities in this week's balloting, including conservative Strasbourg. A growing number of Delanoy's Socialist Party see him as the strongest candidate to defeat Sarkozy in the next election, scheduled for 2012. If that happens, Delanoy would become the world's first openly lesbian or gay national head of state.
A New York City gay activist and his husband are demanding a meeting with Polish President Lech Kaczynski after becoming unwilling poster boys in the infamously homophobic leader's campaign against the European Union's proposed Charter of Fundamental Rights. It would be legally binding on EU institutions such as the European Court of Justice as part of the new reform treaty endorsed by the EU heads of government in Lisbon. Kaczynski showed a photo of Brendan Fay's Canadian wedding to Thomas Moulton in a nationally televised address this week, claiming that the proposed charter could force the legalization of same-gender marriage in the devoutly Catholic country. It wasn't clear how the photo was obtained. Fay and Moulton said they were shocked to find themselves caught up in the controversy when they were inundated with calls from media around the world. Fay told the Times of London that it came totally and utterly out of the blue. He accused Kaczynski of demeaning and insulting our civil marriage contract in a way that dishonored the love and commitment of others like us around the world. For us, it's not so much the personal effect as it is the message, particularly to young people in Poland. Fay also went on Polish radio and television to emphasize that he and Moulton are themselves Catholic and that they met at Sunday Mass. He also sent a formal protest letter to the Polish Consul General in New York saying that we're frustrated to hear that images from such a joyous day are used to spread intolerance. We would never have agreed to permit our photographs as part of a homophobic campaign. The Consul General has reportedly agreed to meet with the pair in the coming week.
Almost 300 people gathered outside the state capitol in Oklahoma City this week to protest the horrendously homophobic comments of Republican State Representative Sally Kern.
The homosexual agenda is destroying this nation. I honestly think it's the biggest threat, even more so than terrorism.
Remarks you heard in full last week on This Way Out. But the Oklahoma lawmaker is standing by them. She told the Associated Press that I see no reason to apologize for what God says, that homosexuality is a sin, and complained that they are trying to vilify me. She said she's received more than 30,000 email messages, some of them threatening, and that someone had harassed her husband, who's a Baptist minister. But Rob Howard of the queer advocacy Cimarron Alliance Foundation of Oklahoma told the protesters that hateful speech leads to hate crimes. He and other speakers renewed calls for passage of a state hate crimes law. Kern's remarks attracted international attention earlier this month after they were recorded and posted on YouTube by the Gay and Lesbian Victory Fund.
And comments by the Vice President of Policy at the notoriously anti-queer Family Research Council are drawing attention this week. Discussing the Uniting American Families Act, a bill in Congress to allow U.S. gays and lesbians to sponsor their foreign partners' immigration, just as binational heterosexual couples do, Peter Sprigg told a reporter for the Medill Reports at Northwestern University that
we oppose this bill because it's part of an assault on the definition of family. I would much prefer to export homosexuals from the United States than to import them into the United States, because we believe that homosexuality is destructive to society.
Rachel B. Tiven of Immigration Equality, a national group working to end LGBT discrimination in U.S. immigration law, said those remarks supported the forced exile of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender American citizens. Rhetoric that endorses the removal or eradication of any group is simply intolerable. The most recent U.S. Census, which is 8 years old, counted almost 36,000 households headed by same-gender couples where one partner was not an American citizen. Hundreds of lesbi-gay couples have been forced to leave their U.S. homes and move to one of the 19 countries that do recognize binational same-gender relationships. The Uniting American Families Act has gone nowhere in Congress and isn't likely to as long as George W. Bush is president.
We've been reporting in recent weeks about several queer asylum cases around the world. News stories surfaced this week about a 19-year-old gay Syrian requesting asylum in Scotland and an 18-year-old gay Cameroonian seeking refuge in Switzerland. A deportation order was issued against Syrian gay teen Jojo Jaco Jacob after he was arrested in Scotland for possession of a fake Belgian passport and placed in a detention facility. His lawyers say his asylum application was mishandled by authorities. Jacob told reporters that he fled Syria 2 years ago after being arrested for distributing anti-government leaflets and surviving severe abuse at the hands of police and prison guards after they discovered that he's gay. He said he was beaten so badly that he fell into a 20-day coma. He escaped to Lebanon soon after he was released from the hospital and eventually made his way into Scotland. Jacob will appear before a full immigration hearing in Glasgow on May 7th to determine his fate.
And according to a report this week on the British queer website Pink News, Switzerland is due to return a Cameroonian teenager to his home country, where he could face prison and physical abuse. 18-year-old Anatole Zali arrived in Switzerland from the West African country in February and immediately sought asylum. He told authorities that he hid at his cousin's home after police officials threatened his life because he's gay. He said his cousin was then arrested on suspicion of being gay. Zali fled to Switzerland after an arrest warrant was issued for him. His appeal for asylum was denied in mid-February. Under Swiss law, however, asylum seekers are not given state-funded legal assistance, and Zali had to submit all of his asylum papers without legal representation. Amnesty International argues that Switzerland has obligations under international law to give him access to a fair and thorough asylum process, and to not return anyone to a country where they would be at risk of serious human rights violations. Organizers of a campaign on Zali's behalf are urging Swiss authorities not to deport him to Cameroon, where he's likely to face arrest and homophobic violence because of his sexual orientation.
But finally, a Tel Aviv family court has ordered the registration of a gay couple as the fathers of a five-year-old boy, and the Israeli government has agreed to do so. One of the men, Avi Shadiv, adopted the boy 4 years ago in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. His longtime partner, Giora Shavit, had applied to Israel's Interior Ministry to be registered as the boy's second father. The ministry refused, and the couple then went to court. The landmark ruling in their favor makes them the first gay male couple in the country to win a lawsuit seeking joint adoption. It's the latest in a series of legal victories for gay and lesbian couples in Israel. Last year, the country's Supreme Court ruled that the government must register, though not necessarily recognize, the marriages of same-gender couples who wed in countries where they're legal. Israeli courts have also ruled in favor of lesbian couples where one had conceived a child in vitro and the other wanted to be listed as co-parent. Shavit told the Jerusalem Post of his successful adoption case that, "I wanted to become a father to him in every sense of the word." Of course, he added, "I know that this will affect other decisions regarding gay and lesbian couples in the future."
That's News Wrap for the week ending March 22, 2008. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Rick Watts.
And I'm Sherry Lund.
From the album Mosaic GMCH, this is the Gay Men's Chorus of Houston, and they're on deck next.
If there's a path to comfort or a road to relief, I know you'll take me there. You'll take me there somehow. Finding this friendship has restored my belief in the joy that pain. So grab
is the Gay Men's Chorus of Houston, and they are in the studio now.
Well, we have some, before we go to the Gay Men's Chorus, we have some late breaking news from Pride.
Wow.
Apparently tonight they made their the announcements of their grand marshals.
And I guess Dalton DeHart will not be snapping photos from the sideline, because he'll be more in the position to have photos taken of him this year, Pride. Being one of the male grand marshal.
Our female grand marshal this year will be Kelly McCann of AIDS Foundation Houston.
And the organization is AIDS Foundation Houston.
And the honorary goes to the diva herself, Julie Eberle.
Way to go, Julie.
That was just announced tonight at Cafe Adobe.
Wow. Hey, you know, we have something totally awesome coming up with the Gay Men's Chorus here in Houston. And it is called Totally Awesome Echoes of the 80s, Greatest Hits of the 80s. And in the studio tonight, we have Colleen Fisher here with us.
Hey, everybody. How you doing?
So, tell us about what we can expect. It's is it a week from tonight?
It is a week from tonight. So, Monday, March 31st at 7:30 p.m. at Jones Hall. We're going to be cranking it up. Grab your bangle bracelets, grab your fingerless gloves, and your red leather jackets, ladies and gentlemen. It's going to be a rockin' 80s festivus party.
Parachute pants.
You know it.
Members only jackets.
The Michael Jackson glove.
You know it. If you have it, bring it out. Any sort of thin leather tie would be completely appropriate that night.
I know. I still got a couple of those in the closet.
See, I wasn't born in the 80s, so I don't know. No, I'm just kidding.
I bet if we told you some of these songs, you know a bunch of them.
Heck yeah.
God, who does not know Mickey? I mean, come on. We're talking about the days of MTV, you know, and how about the big one itself, Thriller by Mr. Michael Jackson.
So the chorus will be a joint chorus between the men and the women, is that correct?
No, actually, this is men only.
Men only.
Men only. The ladies will be hovering in the lobby that night, but they will be nowhere near the stage. So
for those of you that have not attended a concert lately, it's now at Jones Hall, is that correct?
It is at Jones Hall. Yep, all of our concerts are at Jones.
It's perfectly made, I mean, for the sound. The chorus sounds awesome in there. I mean, it really does add a little.
It is. It's a great hall to perform in. We're really, really lucky.
How long has this been going on?
Well, the chorus itself, we're in our 29th season, and September is actually going to be 30 years for us. And then the move to Jones Hall was about 2.5 years ago. It was for Christmas of 05 was the first concert in Jones Hall. We had been singing the Wortham and at Hobby Center and Baring Church. God love Baring Church. I don't know what we'd do without it. No pun intended. So finally the shift came, and Jones Hall it was, and we've got a great staff, and it's a great location, and couldn't ask for a better venue.
Where can, if you're interested in hearing this concert, where can people get tickets?
Tickets are actually pretty easy to come by. You can call the office at 713-521-7464. You can talk to Sandy. She's our box office rep. She'll be more than happy to help you out. You can also go online to www.BayouCityPerformingArts.org. And in the upper right-hand corner, there's a little button for tickets. Click on that. It'll take you right to the ticket page, and you can start looking for the show. Totally Awesome will be over on the left-hand side.
It couldn't be easier.
It's right there. You just go to the homepage at BayouCityPerformingArts.org. It's right there. You got links to what you need.
Okay, if that's not enough, let's flash back and kind of get some of the highlights that we'll hear in the concert. Can you give us some information, Brian?
Oh, boy. They really have it broken up into something that I really like. I mean, you start off, you know, in here with a bunch of medleys, it seems. And our favorite might be right off the bat, the gym, you know, because only at the gym
exactly.
will you get physical and you have muscles, you know, with Diana Ross, Miss Diva herself. And, actually, one of my favorites with the waitresses. You know, I know what boys like. And I think we all know what boys like.
Tony, you, if nothing else, you will be singing this show for the weeks to come. All these songs will get stuck in your head. It's such a great lineup of songs.
I mean, I love the 70s ABBA concert, and that was awesome. So I can't imagine what the 80s concert will be.
Well, definitely. And ABBA was one of those shows that people just come back and, like, we loved ABBA. It was such a great show. And then we did the 60s show probably like 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. We did the 70s show a couple years ago. And we just have so much fun. And we do all, like, the TV skits and just all sorts of craziness is coming out. I mean, the guys will be in costume. It's just from start to finish, it's going to be a showstopper.
Yeah, I mean, and what's one of your favorite movies in the 80s that you can come up with that's going to be in the show? You can just name a couple of them.
Flashdance.
On there. Xanadu. On there.
Oh, Xanadu.
Ghostbusters, yeah. I think, is on there.
Ghostbusters, totally on there. I mean, this is going to be great, you know, just nonstop. And damn it, we are here. We're going to have to just get a performance.
Well,
somebody else is going to be lucky enough to go.
Unfortunately, I have tickets, so I'm going to go. My partner's
Let's
making me go.
Let's correct that listening audience. I am going to be here. Brian with an I will be here. Well, Brian with a Y is having an awesome, totally 80s experience.
I'm going to be at
the
concert.
And they'll come back and recap you all the exciting moments that nobody else listening has to miss.
Now, another feature of the concert is a performance by the Flyboys of Houston.
It is. We are really, really lucky. A lot of our chorus members have performed over the years to dance, but this year we decided to break out. We've got a great relationship, and so the Flyboys of Flag Troop Houston are going to be performing, and I was lucky enough to be in the Pride stands in June and got to see them do the little pre-show warm-up in front of the judges' station, and they were outstanding. They are a great group. They are so talented. And not only that, but they are some, I'm a lesbian, but they are some of the best looking guys I have ever seen. They are fantastic. And
oh my
it's going
to
be great to have them.
Now, if a lesbian notices you, there you go.
Yeah, see? So you're set.
Well, and they were performing yesterday at Bunnies on the Bayou, and they did a wonderful job. So shout out to Markle and Mike and everybody in Flyboys. David Alcalao.
Way to go, Flyboys.
They were all glittery. And their little spandex.
You know, even thinking of that, like we're saying, Brian over here is lucky enough, and he's got tickets, and he's getting to go. And for me, if I'm not going, is there any availability of hearing this maybe even on a cassette tape, or will they have a CD of the show coming up?
That's
later
their
on?
80s. No one, what is a cassette?
We'll make cassettes for everyone. It'll be
it'll be a mixtape.
Memory tape. Yeah, exactly. I made this really great mixtape for you. It's so stylish.
You know, I even had a mixtape that went something like this with Material Girl and Uptown, Uptown Girl, Material Girl, back to back. I mean, come on. I thought that was just me. This is wonderful.
You're going to make me start singing here, and nobody wants to know.
Yeah, we'll all break out and sing. We can all take a part.
You will definitely be singing next week when when Girls Just Want to Have Fun is on.
Heck yeah.
So, okay, people are hearing about the concert. They're hearing about this organization. Is it possible for people to audition and join? And
oh, yeah.
How does one do that?
It's actually a really simple process. For the first 3 weeks of every open cycle, which is usually the 3 weeks immediately after a concert or in like the first 3 to 4 weeks of September, because we have a break from June to September, so everybody gets the summer off. But you just show up and you talk to any of the people sitting at tables. Mm-hmm. They're really helpful. Our membership chairs and registration and all kinds of fun stuff. You fill out an easy form and all you have to do is sit in a vocal placement. So there's actually no audition. Everybody
really?
Can sing. Yeah. So my personal stance on this is don't let just the steering wheel and the shower hear you. If you think you can carry a tune, come on out. We'd love to have you join.
See, I think that I can sing, but David, my partner, says I can't. He says I can't hit. I have no. I'm tone deaf.
There are no Simon Cowells in the chorus, so you won't get rejected, dejected, nothing.
I've been to many of these concerts, and everyone sounds great. I mean, it just really comes.
It's
together.
Really James. James Nant, the artistic director, has a fantastic ability to just get people to sing at their best, and you can rely on the voices around you to just kind of pull everything together. It's great.
You know whose voice I really like is it Ken Claiborne?
Kenneth Claiborne.
Yes, he plays the piano and then he starts singing.
He does.
A
he has
voice.
Got a rockin' voice. He is our associate director. He's fantastic, and he brings a lot of talent to the chorus. We're lucky to have him.
Now, how many people are in the chorus? I mean, it looks pretty big.
Yeah, the men's roster is probably about 100 people or so. And then, obviously, those numbers fluctuate given the different concerts. Like, right now is the time of year when we lose all of our accountants and teachers because the tax are coming up for the school districts.
I know.
So everything fluctuates. But we've got about 100 guys on the roster, and we're proud to have them.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then we've also got our women's chorus, which we'll be talking about hopefully in the next couple weeks because for their concert in May.
And what concert is that? Give us a heads up on that.
It's going to be a great show. It's the best of the 40s.
Oh,
so,
big,
you know,
band?
Some of it's big band. It's going to be, you know, Chattanooga Choo Choo and, you know, the A Train and
Pennsylvania 65,000.
Hell yeah. It's going to be, also, we're going to be breaking the ladies out in their first shot at costumes for a concert, which will be a lot of fun. We haven't quite done that with them yet, so they're pretty young, but so that's going to be a good time. Good time we had by all.
That sounds like a great one. I'll have to break out like my grandmother's Time Life swing set and have Bri over so he can learn some of these tunes too, but he probably already knows them. He's got them on downloaded.
I love the big band stuff.
It's great. It's going to be a great show. And then we've got some other great music by female performers to finish out that. And that's May 17th and 20th, but you can find more information about that on our website.
Okay, so let's
give the website one more time.
Yeah, let's refresh for people.
Cliff Notes version is totally awesome. Echoes of the 80s. It's the greatest hits of the 80s. This coming Monday, a week from today, March 31st at 7:30 p.m. at Jones Hall. Tickets are available at 713-521-7464 or by hopping on the keyboard and punching in BayouCityPerformingArts.org.
Very good. Is there anything else you want our listeners to know about this wonderful concert next week?
I think this is going to be one of those shows that
people will talk about.
We'll be talking about.
Did you hear that 80s concert?
Did you go to the 80s concert? And so I really don't want people to miss it.
Yeah,
it's
going
to be an awesome night. Please come out. Tickets are our lowest price tickets, tier 4 and 19, and go up to.
You can find that information online.
Okay.
Yeah. You know what? One of the things I like that I noticed, we were talking about a few different people, I guess, in the chorus, and I want to give a shout out to one of my friends there in the chorus, Mr. Mike Ator.
Mike Ator! Yay! Yeah. Mike rocks. He's one of our membership chairs. He's awesome.
Oh, I think he's great.
And I know Eric Plug has been asking me to buy tickets, and all his friends. I've been getting emails, and everybody's like, "Are you going? Have you bought your tickets yet?" So, yeah.
Yeah, Eric is one of our new members, and he has been nothing but outstanding in selling the tickets, just pushing it, and he's been awesome. We're, like, floored by the amount of ticket sales he's been able to bring in and the support he's given. He's an awesome new member. We're lucky to have him.
And he's singing in the Thriller ensemble.
He is.
Ooh. Thriller.
You were all going to start singing. I thought we swore we weren't going to do this.
No. We'll leave it to the professionals.
Exactly.
The members.
We'll just keep ours in the shower or in the steering wheel.
Steering wheels.
I sing to in my truck, and I sing in the shower, and I sing to my dog.
I'm one of those people with the iPods on my head running around Memorial Park screaming out and petrifying people.
Well, at least they know you're coming at that point. But, it's awesome. It's great. I mean, I know I've been singing these for a while. In fact, Rock the Casbah, although not in the show, which is upsetting to me, is the phone ringer.
They just leave the Clash out being too political. Come on. Why is it always so political with the Clash? We love the Clash. I love the Clash.
They rock.
Yeah.
So I'm a complete product of the 80s, and I can't wait for this show.
That was a much more innocent time and just a more fun time, it seems like.
Well, it was certainly all about pastels and neon colors, so.
Absolutely. I was watching the movie Once Bitten today.
Oh, my Lord.
And it was such a flashback.
Jim Carrey.
It was awesome. I'm like, oh, this is so 80s. All right. So join the Gay Men's Chorus next Monday night at Jones Hall.
And Brian Levinka will be there.
I'll be there. And I'm sure Dalton will be there taking pictures. And I can't wait. I'm already getting geared up. I'll get my little skinny tie out and my members only jacket.
Definitely. Any sort of straight or, you know, tapered pant and crazy looking shoes, you're
get
there.
Get some mousse for your hair.
You know
mousse. You gotta have that mousse.
Any flock of seagulls hairdos out there, bring them on. Let's go.
All right. Colleen, thank you for coming. And
thank you for having me.
Our listeners. All right. Join us next Monday.
And you were listening to Queer Voices.
of Houston will be performing next Monday night at 7:30 at Jones Hall. This is Queer Voices.
Do, do, do. Static is raining on the radio. I am searching for a smile, so I turn the knobs and move along. Searching for a tune that makes my heart beat, shakes my spine, makes me move my feet, pick up my pace and hum a song. You are a classic butter keeper. Always make me stronger when I'm weaker. Hey now, my boyfriend's back. Remember riding down the highway, holding your hand as you lean my way. A smile, a whistled melody. Your notes are etched into my brain. It don't matter what else the world sings. I just want perfect harmony. You are a classic butter keeper.
Just a taste there of Ron Morris, and J.D. has Ron online now. Go, J.D.
And this is J.D. Doyle, and it was just a taste of the music of Ron Morris. The song is called Boyfriend. It's from his latest release, an EP, and he also had a release in 2004, one of my favorite albums called Speak True. You can get more than a taste of Ron Morris this Thursday evening, because Ron will be performing in Houston at a great venue called Mojo Rising. Ron, welcome to Queer Voices.
Thank you. It's good to be here, J.D.
And you're in Longview, Texas right now. You're on your Tennessee and Texas tour?
Exactly. The Long Road Tour.
You had a gig a little bit ago in Tennessee, and then you're going to be in Austin Wednesday night?
Exactly, right? And then into Houston on Thursday, and then back up to Tennessee.
Okay. It's always interesting for me to hear an artist describe their own music. Will you do that for me?
Sure, absolutely. I would say my music is classified best as folk pop, and to me that means storytelling music that you can sing along to. So I've always been a fan of a good pop melody, and the storytelling is at the heart of why I write music. So that's how I would best describe it, folk pop.
I think that's a good description. How has your music evolved since your first album? That was 2004.
Yeah, you know, it's evolved quite a bit. I just spent the last year and a half in the studio, and really this time around have taken the producing reins, which was a step into the dark for me, but a wonderful leap of faith in really planting down what, from my perspective, the sound that my music was going to take next. I had some great friends in the studio with me and during Speak True that really helped shape the possibilities of what, you know, what was out there with the little basic song that I created. And now I feel like I'm really getting a sense of where I'm heading and where I'm at, which has been wonderful in the studio. And now it's, you know, this wonderful chance to get out on the road and really start putting it out there in the universe and you know, share it with the people.
You haven't done really a lot of that, have you, outside of the New York area? Ron, I said you haven't really done a lot of touring outside of New York, have you?
I'm sorry, say that again, JD?
I said you haven't really done much touring outside
of the New York
area.
You know, with Speak True, I really hit the road and spent a few weeks out on the road doing the East Coast. And then after Speak True, you know, I sort of life filled up real big with a lot of the stuff I was singing about on Speak True, and I moved out of New York City, actually, and got a house out in Pennsylvania and was really able to absorb myself in life in a different way and start working on in the studio again. And now it's all about the road. So, you know, we've got a lot of stuff booked here the next few months, and it just seems to keep coming, which is really exciting.
Well, your latest release is, as I said, an EP called Boyfriend, The Other Sides of Love. How has that been received?
It's been received very well, actually. You know, it's a very playful EP. When we went in the studio to start working on the new full-length CD, I had Boyfriend, and it was one of the first songs we recorded. And Boyfriend has always been a song that, although I love playing and writing ditties, it had its own little feel to it, and I wasn't exactly seeing how it was fitting into the new CD, so we started playing in the studio a bit and really decided to play with the whole notion of the hopeful romantic and look at love from a few different sides. And so we, you know, laid down Boyfriend and did a few more tracks that sort of took a different slant and a different perspective, and then had some remixes done of Boyfriend, which was an entirely new experience. And I think really in a lot of ways has introduced me to a whole other group of people, which has been wonderful. Music listeners who listen to music, you know, for different elements, which has been really great.
And there's a video that's doing quite well on Logo.
Yeah, absolutely. That's been a wonderful thing. We shot a video, which was my first experience doing that, and was a huge blast, directed by George Leiter. And it's been doing really well on Logo. We've been on the top 10 here the last few months, which has been great, and really sent a lot of wonderful people our way and new fans, which has been awesome.
We got about two more minutes. I know you're working on a new album. Will you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, actually, it is all finished. The new album is called Truth Stains Lies, which was the album I originally went in the studio and started pulling songs to do a couple of years ago. And it is all finished, all mixed and mastered, and it comes out June 24th. So Boyfriend has given me this great opportunity to get myself back out there on the road again, start meeting people, reconnect out on the road, doing shows. And the video has been sort of a great ambassador for that, you know, having a lot of different folks coming out to the shows in cities I haven't been to before. And now we're sort of ready for Truth Stained Lies, which... I'm really excited about the sound that we were able to create and the depth of the storytelling has changed and grown, and I'm really excited to share that.
Good. We're up against the clock, I'm afraid. Let me give the details. You're at ronmorrismusic.com. This Thursday you'll be at Mojo Risin at 8 p.m. That's at 1600 Shepherd Drive. That puts it three blocks south of I-10. That's a very nice, intimate venue. I love that venue. And we're going to go out with a song from Ron's 2004 album called Have to Do. And thank you for being with Queer Voices.
Oh, it was great being here. Nice talking to you, JD. See you out there at the show.
Have to Do, Glenn.
And they talk on, giving a wave of the hand. They don't quite play right. When it's high stakes, big bucks, all supply and demand. Buy you out, sell you short on this dream of the promised land. What do I have to do for the good life, for the big time? Do I have to do? Throw your pennies in a cup and you save up, dream on, stretching your arms to the sky. Stars seem too damn high to touch, but you reach on as your bones ache. What will it take to fly? Pick up, drag on. Dream of the promised land. What do I have to do for the good life, for the big time? What do I have to give to keep up, to play nice, be true? What do I have to do? Take the day. Away, let the work become. do I have to do?
This is Queer Voices.
Join Citizens League for Environmental Action now as we present the documentary What a Way to Go as part of our ongoing environmental film series. 7 p.m. April 9th at the Rice Media Center on Rice University campus, located at the corner of Stockton and University Boulevard. In What a Way to Go, a middle-class man comes to grips with peak oil, climate change, mass extinction, population overshoot, and the demise of the culture empire. The film addresses the questions, what is it doing to us? We face the challenges of peaking fossil fuel flow rates, critically degraded ecosystems, the changing climate, an exploding global population, teetering global economies, an unstable political climate, and what is it doing to the rest of the life on this planet? The event is free and open to the public. For more information, visit Clean at www.cleanhouston.org. This is KPFT, Houston.
We'll catch a wave to romance, family, and shelter later in the program.
My family claims the right to know what's wrong with me. They say I'm not turning out the way that they'd better be. My mother's given up my marriage, my father's given up his son. The Holy One is where a woman loving women when it's said and done. God's will, woman loving women.
Teresa Trell's Woman Loving Women was one of the first great lesbian feminist anthems, and Olivia Records was the audacious little California collective that brought it to the world. This way, our correspondent Elaine Meislisch got Olivia pioneer and President Judy Dlugacz talking about the company's pivotal place in the evolution of women's music.
Judy, how did Olivia get started?
Well, we started in 1973 as a record company. There were 10 friends who were also strong, radical, lesbian, feminists.
Mm-hmm.
And what we wanted to do was we wanted to change the world and let everyone know about this wonderful possibility of women being woman-identified, where they could have strong, independent lives and be lesbians at the same time.
And who were the women that were part of this?
Well, the original group were 10,
mm-hmm.
but after 1 year, it became 5.
Mm-hmm.
And so the main living and working collective that we became when we mm-hmm. moved from D.C. To California, L.A., we went to L.A. to learn the record business.
Mm-hmm.
So there were 5 of us, and mm-hmm. that was myself, Judy Dlugacz, and Meg Christian, and Ginny Burson, Jennifer Whittle, and Kate Winter.
Now, you had said to me previously...
Yes.
That Chris, you had seen Chris Williamson do a concert, and she was the one that posed the question to you, why don't you start your own women's producing
right.
company?
Record company.
Record company.
Yeah. They wanted to all start a women's recording company because she had recorded an album for Ampex, which was a major label at the time, and they folded soon after.
Mm-hmm.
And then she went to all the major labels, and they all said, well, we already have a woman artist. So it was like, oh, you have one woman artist, because they didn't believe that women were actually a market that would buy their records.
Uh-huh.
I don't, you know. So it was incredibly sexist time in
mm-hmm.
the industry. Even though there was some fabulous music being made,
mm-hmm.
the industry heads were sexist. The whole industry, there were no women producers, no women engineers, no women backup musicians. They just had the women up there singing. So
mm-hmm.
you know, as a matter of fact, throughout the years of Olivia Records, when I did interviews and they'd say, well, why are you just working with women? I would say, well, if you could name me five women drummers, five women bass players, five women guitarists, five women producers or engineers, I will close Olivia. And they were never able
to
do that in the many, many years of Olivia.
Uh-huh. And you had said earlier that your first recording was a 45. Could
yes.
you share that again?
Yes, we did a 45, which was a little disc
mm-hmm.
with a, you know, you put a little plastic in the middle to have it go around on your record player.
You have your little carrying
yes.
record player that you opened up. Yes.
And it was Meg Christian on one side singing a song called Lady by Carole King,
mm-hmm.
and Chris Williamson on the other side singing a song called If It Weren't for the Music.
Mm-hmm.
And that particular song really told the story. Even though she wrote it before she was involved with Olivia, it was all about if it weren't for the music bringing us together in a natural way,
mm-hmm.
we'd be looking for the way to say I want to be your good friend, which was completely the music. It was such a brilliant idea because music hits people really in their hearts first
mm-hmm.
and in their minds second. And so at a time when coming out or being a lesbian was either not unheard of or something to be just afraid of, and women's sexuality was so not understood even by women at that
right.
point, that something that hits you in your soul before you have to think was a very significant step. So we created literally over the years hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of concerts.
Yes.
Helped people learn to produce in their own cities, helped the bookstores stay alive with the records being sold there, women's bookstores.
Mm-hmm.
They were all over. And
yeah.
so there was this mini economy happening around the music.
I'm flying
Chris Williamson singing If It Weren't for the Music, the first release by then-fledgling Olivia Records in 1973. Elaine Michalis continues her conversation with founder and president Judy Dlugacz about the landmark label's rich musical history. Next time on This Way Out.
Hi, this is Janice Ian, and you're listening to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. Support your local public radio station. You ain't gonna get this nowhere else.
One more bad excuse before you turn me loose. Give me something to remember you by. Couldn't
A gay surfer movie has finally caught a slow wave into U.S. theatrical and DVD release after winning awards at LGBT film festivals across North America last year. This Way Out's Steve Pride has preview clips and talks with the film's neophyte writer-director Jonah Markowitz about Hanging Tough and Hanging Ten.
I hear you've been hanging out with Sean.
Surfing.
Well, you know about him, right?
What about him?
He's gay.
No, Gene. We've been surfing together since I was 8.
Yeah, was that all?
Yeah, what are you saying?
Nothing.
Good.
Like, I don't think that he's the best guy to be hanging out with all day half naked, if you know what I mean. I don't want Cody around that.
What? Why?
It's like, you're not a fag, right?
Gene.
Wait, you never tell me anything. How am I supposed to know?
What do you think?
I'm Jonah Markowitz. I'm the writer-director of Shelter.
And what's Shelter about?
Shelter is a coming-of-age story about a young artist who is also a surfer. He falls in love with his best friend's older brother over the course of a summer. And he's also taking care of a child who is his nephew. And he sort of learns to create this family while dealing with his own family. The family that he's born with, he learns to also create this family and create a family for this kid as well as for himself.
What inspired this?
Where I grew up in Colorado, I was up by a lake in the mountains. I saw these two figures throwing this frisbee back and forth, and I was just thinking about who they were and how they knew each other, and were they brothers or were they friends or, you know, possibly were they lovers? And so I just started thinking about how this relationship seemed so natural, and it was outside, and I thought how great it would be to see a film where the two characters, the two guys, actually fell in love outdoors, and it wasn't in a bar and it wasn't in a locker room, but it was this real genuine sort of real male place where traditionally where guys would hang out. That's how I kind of came up with the setting, and then I knew I wanted to write a story about family and about these two guys raising a kid, so I merged sort of those two ideas and started writing it. And it sat in a drawer for about 4 years until J.D. DeSalvatore found it, and she took it to the Hair Networks, and then we're making the film about 3 weeks later.
In fact, the shoot itself was only 3 weeks. 3 weeks is not a long time for a first-time director.
For the shoot.
For the shoot, yeah.
Yeah, I'm an art director and a production designer. I do studio films, so I'm really used to long schedules and having a few months to do these things. And we had a really limited budget, so we really had to condense the shooting schedule. And I really wanted to shoot it in December. We started prepping in November, but I really wanted to get it done in December because the waves are good and it's clear out. And I also knew I could get some great people to work on it. Some of the people I work with on features would be able to come and do it in December because usually they're not shooting those kind of films in December. So we just had to do it, and we had 18 days, and we just made every single minute count. And we were getting up at 3:30 in the morning and throwing our actors in the water at 5 in the morning in the freezing cold and shooting until the very last minute of sunset. And, you know, I think it worked in our advantage in that we really had to focus on what was important and just get through it, and didn't have a lot of time to do any extra stuff, but everything we did really had to be a part of the story. You know, I think when we edited the film, I think there's one scene we shot that's not in the movie, like one tiny scene, which is pretty amazing.
More nudity for the DVD? Or
what you see is what you get, I think, unless here's got something up their sleeve I don't know about. You know, it was important to me that the movie was really about intimacy, and that's what we were showcasing. We weren't showcasing these bodies, but we were showcasing emotions and feelings, and that's why in a lot of these intimate scenes you're looking at their face, which to me is refreshing to see in a film like this. So that was really the focus in those scenes, was to show what they were thinking.
And the emotional journey is both real and wrenching, as Zach struggles to make sense of both his sexuality and his feelings for Sean.
I need some time. I just don't know if this is really what I want.
Seems like what you want.
I just don't know if this is what I want, for good.
What's that supposed to mean?
It's not as easy for me as it is for you. You know, this is all totally new to me.
Look, we'll get through the game thing.
No, it's not that, Sean. You just don't get it, okay? I can't just take whatever I want. My life is not like that.
You'll never get what you want unless you take it.
Take it? You know, you and Gabe have always just been able to point and take, no questions asked. You don't realize that it's not like that for other people. It's ignorant.
Oh, and you and Gene just blame everyone else because you can't do anything for yourselves? What do you call that?
Why are you doing this?
Don't get all emotional fag on me, okay?
What?
What do you want people to take away from the film?
I want people to see that if you can create love, you can create family. And we have our families that we're born with, and then we have our families that we create. And a lot of us, being gay and living in these times that we do, we move away from our families, and we move to cities, and we create these these groups of friends that do become our families, and I think that they help us create our identities just like our families, and I think if you have love, you can create family.
What sort of feedback have you had from audiences at the film festivals?
I've been approached by gay surfers, I've been approached by gay parents, I've been approached by a lot of people that really relate to, a lot that relate to Trevor's character and some that relate to Sean's character, but in different ways of the film really felt that they related and hadn't seen themselves portrayed that way and were really touched by that. So that was just really amazing for me because we always wanted to make a movie that felt real and genuine that people could relate to. I remember in San Francisco after our premiere, this gentleman came up to me on the street outside the theater, and he had started a group where he was working with guys who had come back from Iraq who were gay, and who a lot of them had come out to the soldiers that they were over there with while they were over there. And he said that he really related to it because the way that the friends dealt with Trevor coming out in the movie, how everyone sort of was okay with it, and you know, everyone was just sort of more surprised that he hadn't told them sooner, and they were still there for him and they wanted to help him through it. And that was actually, he said, a lot of the soldiers he had talked to had that same experience, so he was really excited to show it to them and he thought they would be able to relate to it. So you know, a lot of people in different ways related to the film, and I think that's the best thing you could hope for as a filmmaker. I mean, I think that's what makes it all worthwhile.
Why didn't you tell me?
Tell you what, I don't care at all. I don't know who you're talking about.
Okay. Have you always known?
Seriously, dude.
Okay. The fact that it's my brother is totally weird.
I know.
No, like, really, really weird.
All right, I got it. I'm sorry.
Don't be sorry.
Don't tell anyone, okay?
This has been a conversation with writer-director Jonah Markowitz. Shelter is being released by Hair Films and stars Trevor Wright and Brad Rowe. And if it doesn't make it to a theater near you, don't worry, because it's being released on DVD at the end of May. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Lie, oh, why you're leaving early. Deny that you're in any hurry. Cry and tell me not to worry. What I don't know is never gonna hurt me. Breathe, now baby, don't feel guilty. Deceive me.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT.
Voices Breaking Boundaries and Words Without Borders present Words for Peace 5, Condemn Invasion, on Sunday, March 30th at 7 p.m. at Diverse Works Art Space, 1117 East Freeway, Houston, 77002. Writers, musicians, and cartoonists will offer a window into the culture of Iraq, Lebanon, and Iran, as well as their personal responses to war and invasion. Featured artists include a reading by Iraqi writer Naheem Wali, cartoons by Lebanese artist Massen Kervaj, and much more. All this on Sunday, March 30th, 7 p.m. Onward at Diverse Works. For more information, go to vbbarts.org or call 713-524-7821. This is KPFT Houston.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Belinsky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
Hey! Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy. This way. Fixing desperate rock and roll romance.
Yes, I love the nightlife. This is J.D. Doyle with Queer Music Heritage. And I won't be surprised if you don't recognize that version of the disco hit. It was Done Country by Scooter Lee. And while I don't know if she's gay, I thought it would be a nice way to get your attention and let you know that later in the show, I'll bring you an interview with Alicia Bridges, the artist who made that song a classic. But first up is an artist from Scotland I much admire. She's Horse McDonald and just goes by Horse. And she has been described as an artist who wouldn't have been out of place on the Stax or Motown labels in their heyday. You'll see why. She recently released her 8th full-length album since 1990, and I love it. It's called Red-Haired Girl. On my January show, I named it one of the best of 2007. And I've been a fan of her since 2000, when I was asked to help interview her when she appeared on Jimmy Carper's After Hours show. So I was very ready for her new album, and before I share my interview with her, I want to give you just a taste of one of the new songs. This one is called Catch My Fall.
It's hope that rustles my heart when I'm in the dark. Afraid to go on and ache to give in. No matter how small, no matter how weak, there is a voice that gets us to speak.
I started the interview by asking her to tell us a little about her long career.
How little do you want? Because I could be here all night. I signed my first publishing deal in 1986-87 with EMI and signed my first record deal in 1987, but the first album didn't come out till 1990. I've toured with numerous people like Tina Turner, B.B. King, Aztec Camera. I've opened for, probably one of my favourites was Burt Bacharach, because as a songwriter I greatly admire him, so that was a real career high. I've done a lot of touring with the band Horse, where I began, and latterly do put bands together or players together as and when I need them. I started off wanting to write and record when I was quite small, and I've been very lucky to do that for quite some time now. I've had two major deals. The first one, as I say, was with EMI, and the second one was with MCA Universal.
How has your music changed over the years?
I suppose the listener would be the best person to ask about that. When you sign a deal and you're quite naive, you tend to do as you're told. But you're also trying to work amongst other players. And with the band, there was myself and Angela, the other songwriter, but there was another two or three other musicians. So the chemistry of that is affected by the different musicians, and trying to balance everyone's wishes, wants and needs. And as time's worn on, I particularly write and work on my own mostly with a couple of key musicians that I use. I would say that the music's a little less rock and a little more eclectic now, and that is me, a bit more me, allowing myself to be myself. I tend to try and work with the song first, and that hopefully means that the song will end up on the right vehicle. So I guess I think I've got more control over the years, and I hope a little more emotive.
Which song gets the most audience attention?
There are a few of my songs which get a fantastic response, and again, Careful is one of them. God's Home Movie from the second album, and as I say, Hindsight is one. And from the new album, Fade Away and Catch My Fall get great reactions. I would say that the Careful has become my Frank Sinatra's My Way. Very recently I lost my mum and I lost my dad, and it's been a very difficult time, and Careful, a song I never attached to me for any particular reason, has now very much become attached, because I sang it to my mum before she died, and it's almost like a coming round in a full circle. So I suppose Careful is perhaps synonymous with me now more than it ever was.
Sunshine on your upturned face, everything falls into place. Blue sky above and underfoot, happiest I have seen you look. Sunrise stirs the low landscape, more beauty than your breath can take. Boats out to seagulls in the air, I might look as if I didn't care. Careful with me, careful with my heart. World keeps turning, my world falls apart. When you're out of reach from me, when you're out of reach from me. In between, I've been both and I can't win. If this love should suffer sudden death, it won't be because I'm not myself. I don't forget, I depend upon the simple fact you turn my heart over, over, over.
That was Careful from the first album by Horse, The Same Sky, released in 1990. I know this next song is considered one of her classics, so I definitely wanted to ask Horse about the song God's Home Movie, a song she co-wrote with Angela McAlinden.
God's Home Movie is probably one of my best songs, and God's Home Movie was written with Angela McAlinden. I remember writing the melody, because I tend to write the melodies, or I did tend to write the melodies with that partnership, and I remember exactly where I was sitting. I remember the time of day. It was one of those magical moments where the song, or the melody rather, just came to me like some magical moment. The next part of the process was handing the precious melody over to Angela for her to do lyrics, and the lyrics are probably some of the most beautiful words that she's written. I think the whole theme of the song is the idea of someone you love very much being able to dip into God's treasury or library of snippets of people's lives,
and be able to choose moments from that person's life. And that's the whole sort of theme of the song. I think it's a beautiful idea. And therefore, God's Home Movie is the simplicity of the melody and the simplicity of the lyrics just makes the thing. It's just a magical, magical song. It is one of the most popular songs that I still do. And it was the title of the second album. It's just one of the most popular songs that we've ever done, and very proud of that song.
There's something I'd like to see from God's home movie. The story of the universe and my baby. I'd see you as a child, playing by the sea, just like the story.
That was the title track from her 1993 album, God's Home Movie. Time to get back to the latest album and the song This Time.
This Time is a track which I wrote with Angela. Again, you've chosen tracks that I wrote with Angela McAlinden. I like the darkness of it, but also I like the groove. I think lyrically, again, it's a gem. It's a good Angela McAlinden lyric. It's got a very dark lyric as well. It's It's pretty much about wanting something to work because in the past things have not worked out. It is, again, relationships. You'll try anything, any superstition. You'll try everything to try and get this relationship to work this time. But again, it's the, when I perform it, I feel like it's an angry song. So I certainly give it that. But it's one of those ones where you can almost imagine somebody speaking through gritted teeth. So I tend to sort of sing it in a kind of snarling way. Then when we get to the ad-lib section at the end, where I do literally ad-lib, then I can really go to town with that.
And while it's a tough call, I think my favorite track from the new album is Can't Break My Heart. Can you please tell us about it?
Can't Break My Heart, I think, is one of my favorite songs that I've ever been involved with writing. Can't Break My Heart, melodically, is desperately sad. And the lyric that, again, Angela McAlinden wrote, it's extremely poignant, a very angry lyric as well. And the sadness in the lyric and the melody, a lot of people relate to it. And I did a show, I'm showing off now, but I did a show at the Albert Hall, and I performed to a full house, a big Stonewall concert actually, and I performed Can't Break My Heart with a quartet, just voice and quartet, and people in the front, there's a couple of people in the front row sobbing. So I knew I'd had a successful performance, but also the song in particular had really moved people. Myself, my own situation, I mean, the song is not from last week, the song is a good 7 or 8 years old. Things that have happened in my life in the last 7 or 8 years make the song very personal to me as well. So when I do perform it, therefore I really do put a lot of my own emotion into it. I think when you're writing songs, I think you don't always take the literal meaning of a song. And Can't Break My Heart, the literal meaning of Can't Break My Heart is somebody having had an affair or really done something pretty bad, and the singer or the teller of the story wanting that person out. And when you sing the song, you don't always pick up every single word, but you get the, you know, Can't Break My Heart comes across in a really it just literally slaps you in the face, and the strings are really beautiful as well. So it's a great combination of emotion and passion.
Let me sing and catch my breath. You're not staying, so don't bother to undress. Pour me out a drink before you go gun crazy. I just want to
Again, that was Horse from her new album, Red Haired Girl. And you can find out more about her at www.randan.org. That's www.randan.org. Now, many of us love the movie The Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. There's recently been a stage musical production of it in Australia, and the soundtrack has the cast doing this song. Coming up, my special interview with Alicia Bridges. But this is a good time to invite you to check out my website. If you visit it while you're listening, you can see the playlist and follow along by looking at photos of the artist and recordings. I've always considered our music history as a visual as well as an audio experience. Again, that's at www.queermusicheritage.com. Also, for more very queer programming, please listen to After Hours with Jimmy Carper every Friday night, Saturday morning, from 1 to 4 a.m. on KPFT. It's queer radio with attitude. Now, I very much doubt that I have many listeners who are not familiar with the huge disco hit from 1978, I Love the Nightlife. I'm very pleased to share with you an interview with the artist who recorded and co-wrote that song, Alicia Bridges. And you'll see that the interview got off on the right foot right away.
Well, I was telling a friend of mine, you know, I don't believe it, tonight I'm interviewing Alicia Bridges, and she was very impressed.
Well, all right. I want to tell you that before you ever got in touch with us, I have visited your website many times.
Well, great.
And found a lot of really interesting stuff there and had a lot of fun with it. In fact, I got you saved in my favorites folders.
Good to hear.
I knew who you were.
Okay. Well, that's always nice. Tell me about your career prior to I Love the Nightlife.
Well, first of all, I was on the stage at 5 years old, tap dancing. That was my mother putting me there, and it was fun. I liked it. So I was on the stage at 5 years old. That doesn't count. But I sang all over North Carolina, and also the moment I'm probably proudest of is working with our band Zachary Ridge, which was composed of several guys from Knoxville, Tennessee, and our drummer, Charlotte, North Carolina, and we were playing lots of cover versions of the Janis Joplin music, which was a lot of fun, the Rolling Stones, Led Zeppelin, Uriah Heep, Grand Funk Railroad, and all of those types of things. And it was a really excellent band, and that was probably the most fun. I did a lot of songwriting along the way, and did a lot of work on and off playing my guitar and singing without bands. Then when I found Bill Lowry through Gary Walker was a friend of a friend who was in Tennessee and situated at a recording company there. And Gary, when I met him, took me to Bill Lowry, and Bill was very interested vocally and in the writing that I was doing as well. And that's when I began to write these songs that you're hearing now. So at that point in time, in the mid-70s there, all I did was write songs. He subsidized that with Artist Advances, and so that I could focus completely on songwriting and would not have to be out in a club singing cover versions and being tired and coming home and, oh, I don't know if I want to write a song or not. I was actually writing songs every day. It was a concentrated effort and a beautiful time through actually supporting me until we got the record out.
Can you tell me about the writing of I Love the Nightlife itself?
Yeah, we were in that songwriting, Susan Hutchinson and I were in that songwriting concentrated effort to write, and we were writing anything was considered for an idea. It didn't matter. Bill supported artistic freedom and Just write it all, girl. Write it all, he'd say. He's got that deep voice. And so we did. And so we were writing about everything. And one day I said, let's write a song that has the word disco. And we did, kind of on a lark in a way. Funny. Kind of on a lark. And as the song was, we wanted to make up with this person in the second verse, but Bill didn't like that idea. No, don't make up with this joker. Go have a good time all by yourself. Come back and give me a rewrite on that second verse, or last verse. And so we did, and that's how the song stands now. It was his idea to have that second verse. And I think make a man out of you might even have been, he encouraged that line.
That was my favorite line of the song. Maybe that'll make a man out of you.
Thank you. I kind of like that, too. I've always been a smart aleck.
The song was such a huge hit, it must have been overwhelming. Can you kind of tell us about that?
Well, you know, it was, in a way, in a big way, because what Bill would say to me, Bill Lowry, the publishing mogul of the Southeast, gosh, I love that man, he would say, we're going to put this record out now, Alicia, and don't worry if it's not a hit. Don't worry, because if it's not a hit, we'll just make another record. And we'll just keep making another record until something is a hit, so don't worry. And so really, I was more prepared for the song to be a flop than to be a hit. And when it was a hit, and then I had done some television, and then I couldn't go to the grocery store without being recognized, and people would come up behind me and grab me and say, I know who you are. And those kind of things were kind of strange. So, yeah, it was overwhelming, and it was overwhelming to do all the interviews and the traveling and the things. But it was a lot of fun, too.
How many different versions or mixes of that song are there?
I've lost count. Maybe around 20 or so that I know of off the top.
From your first album, the song Body Heat also charted. Can you tell me about that one?
Body Heat. I knew a guy one time. He was a doctor in the Atlanta area, and he had to have people around him all the time. All the time. He gave me the idea. He probably doesn't even know that he was the inspiration for that song. That he could not survive alone in isolation. He had to have the body heat.
Unfortunately, there's so much ground to cover with Alicia that I won't be able to play full versions of the songs, but that one was Body Heat from 1978. Your follow-up album in 1979 was called Play It As It Lays. That got a bit of attention too, didn't it?
It did. It did get some attention. Of course, not like the other one. And I really have got to say at this point that the record company was probably not interested in helping promote that record. Record companies are squirrely.
Can you tell me about the title track, Play It As It Lays?
Play It As It Lays is what I try to do all the time. All the time. You know, honesty means a great deal to me, and always has. And Play It As It Lays I like it when people just tell it like it is.
You say you want to find your place. Say it out loud. Say it so strong. Hold back your hair. Take a look at your face. See it right now. Say it so strong. Oh, oh. Oh, oh. Ah, ah, ah. Woo! Oh, oh, oh. Watch while we dissect your brain.
When in your career did you come out, and was that difficult for you?
I'm going to tell you something today. I don't think I ever told anybody, but I'm going to tell you because this is a special interview. So here's your exclusive. My mother told me when I was 13 years old that she was not going to have a homosexual live in her house. I didn't know what that was. I didn't know what it meant, and but she was extremely angry, and she had pegged me as gay, and I didn't know. I grew up in the country, and we didn't know what that was. I knew that, and as far as being a child, I always liked little girls better than I ever liked little boys, and always that followed throughout my whole life. So I've always been gay, I guess that's how that is, but I didn't know what homosexual meant. So and then my mother proceeded to tell everybody that we were related to that her daughter was a queer. I guess she was a homosexual, and it was hard for me to find any books about this and what it was too. I tried to go into the libraries, but you know, I guess I was about 13 years old, 12, 13 years old. I couldn't find any information, but I knew she was angry. And so really, it's really never been a secret. I've always been out no matter where I've been. And so I guess it was shocked me one time when someone said to me, "Why don't you come out and tell people you're gay?" And I looked at her and I said, "Well, everybody knows it, don't they?" And I guess everybody didn't know it. I have always been very open, and I didn't know that I needed to make a dramatic statement. All my bands have always known I'm a lesbian. Everybody I've known has always known this. Because you know what? I really don't think I had to live any other way. It's not always an easy thing to do, but it's the only way I know how, because I can't be something else. I am what I am. And but anyway, I guess I came out in the Advocate back in the 90s, but I had also marched in gay pride parades and been quite out and open in the 80s publicly, but I don't know if anybody caught on to that. I was in the gay pride in Long Beach and also in San Francisco. Have been doing that for a long time, and I guess I just thought people knew. And maybe they didn't know.
So it wasn't really an issue when the big hit happened?
It really wasn't. Not with any of my people that I worked with or with the Lowry Group. Always knew I was gay and accepted it completely.
How did you become associated with the Olivia Records folks and the Second Wave label? This was 84.
It's pretty simple, really. Susan Hutchison said one day, she said, we ought to get somebody to talk to Olivia Records and see if they're interested in this music, because it's definitely gay, and definitely a lot of it to do with women, And I said, well, I really hadn't thought about that. And she said, well, I think we should call them. And I said, well, Susan, you know, do you think you'll get in touch with anybody that will talk to you? Because your record companies have always, in my opinion, been, you know, kind of unreachable. She did call Olivia Records, and she did talk to Judy Glugach. And that before we knew what was next, she wanted to release that record, and so she did.
Was that record accepted very well? Because it's really a radical change from everything else on their label.
I don't think that. I don't know. You know, it doesn't seem to make any difference where I am. I'm usually like the oddball in the room. It's always been like that. And you know, it's not necessarily a good thing or a bad thing. It's just the way it is. When I was out in California, you know, you would wear your makeup for your shows, and you, David Bowie taught me that. You wear your makeup for your shows, and you do these things, and I really think some of the women that were there looked at me like, you know, that what is this? A gay woman wearing a lot of makeup and costuming, and you know, I hung out with drag queens for years. And drag queens are a lot about putting on a big show. And I'm glad I did. But I think when I got out to California and some of the lesbians around the company looked at me like, what is, you know, nobody out there was wearing any makeup. It was a show. And I think that it's hard sometimes for people to separate the person from the show. But I don't know. But I really had a great time with Chris Williamson and Trent Fury. We had fun. Chris Williamson's got one of the best sense of humor that I've ever run into. She's great. And, you know, so it wasn't everybody, but I think I kind of put some of those gals off a little bit.
You mentioned Susan Hutchinson. She was your writing partner at the time, right?
Yes, she was.
And it looks like quite a bit of your material was written with her.
Yes, it absolutely was.
Well, from the Olivia Records second wave album, Hocus Pocus, despite the heterosexual lyrics, I like the song This Girl Don't Care.
Thank you.
What inspired that?
Well, do you ever just get fed up? I'll go a little further, and I'll tell you that these songs were written at the end of the relationship as partners. As lovers, for me and Susan Hutchinson were breaking up. It was almost over. And a lot of those songs came out of that angst. And I remember when I came to her and I said, I got out of this song. Here's what it says. It says, I don't like you anymore. You treat me like a wholesale item. And I can't see you anymore. And I said, what do you got on that, Susan? And then she wrote the second verse. Right in each other's face. And not with anger. But that's how that song was written.
From Alicia's Hocus Pocus album from 1984, that was a bit of This Girl Don't Care. Some listeners only think of you as a disco artist. How do you react to that?
Well, I think that's probably what some people have only ever known about any of the music I've written. They've only known I Love the Nightlife, and certainly I Love the Nightlife has had more acclaim and has been more popular and played over and over than any of the others. And, you know, that used to bother me. It doesn't bother me as much now as it used to, it used to bother me because I thought, well, what about all these other songs? What about all this other stuff? What are you? And what I've found out is through time that other people do know those songs, and in fact we get correspondence from people who maybe Diamond in the Rough is their favorite, maybe Broken Woman is their favorite, and so you know, I'm getting correspondence in the mail and online, and have through time, through the years that other people have heard those other songs, and I guess I felt I wanted them all to get their chance to at least for people to know they're out there.
For those people who think you may have disappeared since your big hit, can you bring them up to date on your career?
I can indeed. I have been in the process for several years of putting together a studio for Mary and me. We are very deeply involved, and we're doing it ourselves. And also did some little things with the remixes to spiff up the tracks vocally a little bit, and it's been great to hear them sound like this.
Your latest album is called Say It Sister. Can you tell us about it?
Say It Sister, and all of the songs, pretty much speak to truth, you know, and to the life experience of those of us who fall in love. It's about the blues, it's about rock and roll, and of course, we have I Love the Nightlife, which is definitely about partying and the disco.
One of the songs on the album that shows its variety is Broken Woman.
Well, really and truly, from singing in the bars for so many years, gay bars and straight bars, you come to know the people that come in and frequent the bars. Every once in a while, you see a person at that bar night after night after night after night. And they usually have a sad story. And they've usually got worse, I'd say worse than the blues. But it's about seeing people where they are suffering so much that they're trying to kill that pain with the booze. And that's where the song came from.
A broken woman. Oh, man. Sits at the bar. Sipping gin and tonic. She thinks she's the star. The star of the dance floor. The gold. She shakes to the music till the last song is gone. She wants to change, at least that's what she says. But she just can't relate. She just can't find herself. What a foolish broken woman.
Is there a song on the album, the latest album, of which you're the most proud?
Oh, gosh. If I have to pick a favorite, if I have to pick one that's my favorite, it would be the Diamond in the Rough. Diamond in the Rough tells a lot about me personally, and I like the song, and I think it conveys what it is meant to convey. And I think it also speaks to the experiences that some others have probably had, especially as being gay and having people talk about you and, you know, talk about you behind their back. You know, you got to be pretty tough to put up with that. And I think a lot of us have had to go through that in our gay way of life. And I'm not even going to say lifestyle. It's our lives. You got to be pretty tough to deal with that crap.
Heard the way people talk about me. Do you like the things they say? Or do you find it disconcerting and unkind? It's a joke I've learned to live with, being different. They
Diamond in the Rough by Alicia Bridges. When I was thanking Alicia for the interview, I was kind of surprised and very pleased at her reaction.
Well, I can't tell you how flattered I am that you wanted to do this interview with me, because I've been a fan of yours too. and you got some dynamite information on your website. And when Mary told me that you wanted to do the interview, I said, wait a minute, I think I know who that is. Wait a minute. And so I went back to your website there, and all was your beautiful website. But I got really excited, and I am excited to talk to you today because I'm one of your fans.
Well, that's really nice to hear.
It's a thrill. It really is. And I've done interviews through the years, but I don't think I've ever done one that meant quite so much to me.
I'm down to the last song, and you can probably guess what it is. But before I get to it, I want to thank you all for listening. And I want to especially thank Horace and Alicia Bridges for the wonderful interviews. Alicia's website is www.aliciabridges.com. And you can find out more about both artists at my site, www.queermusicheritage.com. And as always, if you have questions or comments about any of the music I featured, please write me at qmheritage@aol.com. This is J.D. Doyle for Queer Voices on KPFT in Houston. Of course, I'm closing the show with I Love the Nightlife Disco Round. Do you have any interesting stories about the phenomenon of that song?
I think the most astounding thing to me is that this song seems to have a life of its own. And it just keeps going and going. And it keeps being accepted and liked by all different kinds of people and all different kinds of age groups, and it's almost like a wild thing out there doing its own thing.
Action.
This is Alicia Bridges, and I love the nightlife, and I love queer music heritage.
You've been listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Walensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, Jennifer Renee, Greg Chapman, and Jack Walensky. Be sure to listen every Saturday night, Sunday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.